Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll hear from Ke'ini Obora Salam, whose new collection of short stories is called Ancient, Ancient. And we'll talk with North Shore novelist Pamela Binnings Ewan, author of Chasing the Wind. Ke'ini Obora Salam is a New Orleans native who grew up in the Lower Ninth Ward. She's the middle child of five, and she belongs to one of those writing Louisiana families. Her father is the prolific poet and essayist Kalamuya Salam. Ke'ini lives in Brooklyn now, where she's an editor and project manager, and she's a writer as well as a painter. She's coming home this month to celebrate her first book of short stories, which has the lovely title, Ancient, Ancient. Ke'ini Obora Salam, welcome.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, so glad to have you on The Reading Life. Tell us about the lovely, evocative title of this book.
Well, the title actually comes from one of the stories within the book called Ancient, Ancient. And I wrote it at a time where I was a little not flowing with my work. I had sort of a period of consternation. And so what I would do is, it's really editors that kept me going, and they would ask me for something, and I would say, okay, well, give me six words. And they would give me six words, and I would just go on pure imagination because I felt like I had run dry in a certain way. So one of the stories, Ancient Ancient, comes from six words that someone gave me, and I went off on this evocative journey. And I thought it was appropriate for the collection because a lot of what I write about is sort of, I feel, ancient and sort of deep to humanity in terms of our impulses and what triggers us and sort of our social issues and all those things that are historical to just the human experience.
Well, it's a lovely title. Now, I should tell our listeners that a lot of these stories are speculative fiction. Tell us what draws you to that kind of writing.
Honestly, it's really to entertain myself. I didn't remember that I was a writer as a little person, but when I went back through some papers, I saw I'd written stories that were based on regular sort of fairy tales, but I would give them some kind of strange twist at the end. And I think when you're a kid, almost a lot of things are speculative. Not everything, but the stories, the animals talk, magical things happen, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's not separated out. But then when we become adults, it's sort of like play, just like play gets put in the corner. I think speculative stories and speculative fiction kind of is regarded a little bit differently, though it's having this huge resurgence in young adult literature with the Hunger Games and Harry Potter and Twilight. It's having a huge sort of moment that hasn't quite permeated the sort of adult literature in the same way. But I write it because it's fascinating and it's interesting. So I wrote a few stories when I was in college that were straight literature, but I was just bored. And one story in particular, the second one in this collection, but the oldest one in this collection, of Wings, Nectar, and Ancestors, there was a moment of a moth on a wall. And I said, well, what if that moth was a signal? And what would that mean if, and I was off? And ever since then, I've been using my imagination through speculative fiction to push the boundaries of what could happen in a story and in literature. And it's just exciting to me.
And it has such a freeing effect in so many ways. Many of these stories deal with aliens inhabiting others, with travel to other worlds, and you had to invent names and language for some of these characters and, I won't say people, but beings, that's the word.
Right. Yeah, I think that early on, I was traveling a lot. And what happened is that I felt like an alien, and I felt foreign. So I would go places, for example, the Dominican Republic, where I could speak only rudimentary Spanish. And I'm communicating with people, and I can understand what they're saying to me, but I can't be my sort of full self with them because I'm limited by language. So I think a lot of those themes of foreignness actually are good metaphors for how we move through life sometimes, where we feel different either because of the circumstances around us where we actually are different, like when you're traveling, or just because of whatever sort of emotional unrest or feelings of smallness you might have in your body, you feel other, you know. And I feel like the alienness is just a perfect way to talk about those feelings of alienation that all of us feel at some point in time in our life.
We should say that after you graduated from Spelman, you had a Watson Fellowship.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
I know, I can just imagine. And you traveled. You traveled a lot, didn't you, for a year?
Right. The Watson is great. It is the Thomas J. Watson Fellowship, which was founded by the son of the guy who created IBM. And some of the literature I read, and I don't know how sort of story-fied it is, so I'm not going to say that it's fact, but I read that, like, at IBM, everything was sort of, like, organized and in rows, and here comes this guy who's, like, sort of free-form, and he really believes in this principle of wandering, and that's how you find yourself. And it's in stark contrast to, like, the roads, like these fellowships where you go and you do serious intellectual inquiry. The Watson, you do inquiry and you write these proposals for these sort of interesting studies that you want to do, but they are basically saying, here, we're going to fund you, and you just promised to leave this country for 12 consecutive months and don't come back, and that's all we're asking. So you go, and there's no main office for you to sort of check into. You just do your own thing. And sometimes people's proposals break down, or the contacts that they had when they wrote the proposal no longer exist. And you call them in a frantic and say, oh, I can't fulfill all my promise. And they say, just choose something else. Take a month, take a breath, choose something else, and go study something else. So that whole sort of permissive attitude towards your ideas and your thoughts, it was really life-changing, number one. And then also just to spend that much time outside of the country and get to know myself in all these different environments and make connections with people outside of the United States, it was just, I think, expansive for me to just imagine how large the world is, and probably impacted me in terms of my interest in imagining beyond the scope of our world.
Oh, yes. Awesome. Such a gift. And I know that early on at a writing workshop, you studied with one of my favorite writers, Octavia Butler.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about her. She's such a wonderful writer. She was. And I think she's so missed by readers. What did working with her do for you?
Well, first, I just want to say that I feel it's not just the literal working with her that impacted me. Her story itself is amazing. Like, she talks about the fact that she worked in so many jobs, like she made potato chips and just did whatever she had to do. And she published a story at a certain point and then didn't publish for ages. And she just had to keep banging her head against the wall. And it is an interesting example for any working artist where you have these ideas, you have this artistic output, and you need support in putting it out there. And of course, with the internet age, we need less and less support. But this whole idea of validation and who can write and who's allowed to write. And she really was her own self. She was her own bold self in a genre that didn't really represent her, but this was unique and authentic to her. So she just kept going. And she made a mark that is, like, indelible for so many people. So I love her for the example of having her vision and continuing to write.
Right. And she was a Zale writer at Newcomb 1 year, and I met her, and she was fierce.
She was fierce, and she was unique. She was like a very tall woman. She had a deep sort of froggy voice. She didn't care about trends. She wore polyester, you know. And I met her before I worked with her. I met her at the National Black Arts Festival where I was interning. And I just remember she was just so curious about the offices. She was just like, what's going on here? What do you do here? And I was like, these are offices. Why do you care? But, I mean, this is just the depth of her intellectual thirst and her curiosity about the world around her, you know, that just impacted me to know that, you know, she's writing, but is not just like to sort of broadcast to the world. It's a real, true, authentic interest in the inner workings of the world, you know?
Right.
Which I think is awesome. And then I actually ended up working with her. So that was sort of like my third touch point with her. And as a teacher, she was just very straight. You know, she was just like, this is what you need to do. You know, you put your blinders on and you do it. She gave us this activity of with a novel that basically a lot of writers come up with their characters in a situation, but they don't ever come up with, like, where they're going. So she had us write sentences that had the full conflict from beginning to end in it, and that we keep it there as we're writing our novels, and we write to get there, because it could be a cyclical process where you're just writing, 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 and you're not going anywhere. And then I had this funny experience with her when I was in the bathroom stall talking to my friend. I don't want to write novels. I just want to write stories. And she was next to me. I had no idea. She was in the next stall. And she's like, you can't. You can't live on stories. You have to write a novel, you know. And I hear that in my ear. And I still haven't published a novel, even though I have a few on my hard drive. So I just think about her fierceness in terms of her commitment to getting it done and doing what needed to be done to get her work out there, you know. So she's really is an amazing literary light because of her skill, of course, but I also take her as a personal example of a writer who fulfills on her promise and follows through and gets it done.
Well, I must say, you seem pretty fierce to me, too. And I know you have a daughter, so I won't be surprised if there's another writing member of your family at some point.
Yeah.
Oh, we've been talking with Keini Oburah-Salam, whose new collection of short stories is called Ancient, Ancient. You can meet Keini Monday, August 13th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books, Wednesday, August 15th at 6:30 p.m. at Maple Street Books at the Healing Arts Center, or Friday, August 17th at 6 p.m. at Community Book Center. Thanks for talking with me, Keini.
Thanks so much for having me, Susan.
My guest today is Pamela Bennings-Ewan, whose new book is Chasing the Wind. Pam lives on the North Shore and writes novels. This book is her fourth, a sequel to Dancing on Glass. Her other novels are Secret of the Shroud, a novel about the Shroud of Turin, and The Moon in the Mango Tree, which was based on the life of her grandmother, who was married to a medical missionary in what was then called Siam, and Faith on Trial, a work of nonfiction. Pam turned to writing after 25 years as a lawyer. She's a member of the board of directors of the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival and the founder of the North Shore Literary Society. She's also a member of that fabled Burke DeBuse writing clan, one of Louisiana's foremost literary families. Hi, Pam.
Hi, Susan.
Welcome. It's
Thank
good to
you.
See you again.
I'm glad to be here today.
Now, when we first met the protagonist of Chasing the Wind, she was a young lawyer in Dancing on Glass. She was just starting out, and she was not happy. This book is considerably more upbeat.
This book was fun to write. It was kind of whimsical and just tied up all the loose ends from Dancing on Glass.
And why did you go back to this character?
Well, I fell in love with the characters, both Amelie and Jude. And of course, I'm in love with the city of New Orleans, and New Orleans is almost a character in my books. So I wanted to tell the rest of the story. Also, an astute reader might have noticed in the background of the book of Dancing on Glass that Amelie often was watching news about the war in Vietnam. This was 1974-75. United States was just getting ready to exit Vietnam. And one of the things that really got to me and personally in that period were the children that were going to have to be left behind. There was something that really personally affected me in those days in the mid-70s. It was when we were exiting, the United States was exiting Vietnam. And Operation Baby Lift was such a heroic thing. It was an effort by the United States and private enterprises as well to use planes and just jam the babies into the planes, pack them in as many as they could, and got them out of the country as fast as they could before the North Vietnamese came along. But what was also going on at the same time, it wasn't quite as high profile, was the fact that the Khmer Rouge were getting ready to take over Phnom Penh and Cambodia. And that was almost even more tragic because there weren't as many people paying attention to the children in Phnom Penh. And I can remember some brave reporters that stayed right to the very end, to the last day when the Khmer Rouge marched into Phnom Penh. And I remember seeing pictures of these little orphan children, and they would stand on the airstrip at the airport and wait for a plane that would come over. It was Air America, and every night it would come, and they would drop a pallet of food for the children onto the tarmac. And so here we were, the last day, the Khmer Rouge are moving in. This same pack of little children were standing on the airport runway waiting for the plane, and the reporter in the background was almost crying, and he said, "The plane isn't going to come, but they don't know that. This is the end." And sure enough, when the Khmer Rouge marched in and no one really knew what was going to happen, a veil of silence dropped over that country, and we now know what happened. It was the killing fields. Mm-hmm. But so the pictures of those little children on the airport runway in Cambodia stayed in my mind. It was actually a cause of mine for a while when I was beginning law school and I lived in Texas. I was raising money for them and trying to raise the awareness because no one knew what had happened to those little children. So writing Chasing the Wind was a lot of fun, but it also allowed me to bring this issue forward, these little children that were left behind, in the form of one young boy. And it's a happy story. It's not a sad story. It's not, he escapes Cambodia. And what happens is just such a fun thing to do. It was almost a circle. We have Bingham Murdoch, who flies into town, and he's a business mogul, and he's getting ready to do a big financing. And we have Amélie's Catois, who's in love with Jude, and Jude's in love with her, but neither of them know that the other loves them. And Amélie's is going strong with her career in the law firm, and she's working on the financing that Bingham sets up. And I don't want to spoil the story, but the child brings everything together and ties it all up neatly in the end.
And he's a very charming child. You want to know him.
I fell in love with him. Mm-hmm. And I used memories from my own experience with my own child when he was about that age, how children think and how they make you feel and how you want to protect them. And if they smile, you smile, that kind of thing.
And in this novel, you create this potential change to the face of the quarter
that's
bound to be very controversial. Uh-huh. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I really had fun with that because I hope the Marigny District residents will forgive me for throwing this scare into the book. But you remember when the expressway was going to be built through the quarter? And there was such a commotion over it. There was protests and everything. That's one of the things I love about New Orleans, is that nobody here is passive. If you try to cut down the wrong tree in this city, you might as well make a run for it, because there will be protests and there will be songs and there will be people shouting, and it'll be on the front page of Susan Larson's old paper, and it'll just be everywhere. That was a fun thing. The financing that Amélie's is working on, I made it outrageous. It was outrageous, and it was going to be something that was going to be about the equivalent of the expressway, and I just sort of took that and ran with it.
And one of the other fascinating things about the financing stuff is that a lot of the suspense comes from lawyers doing paperwork, which is pretty amazing.
Well, I'm so glad you said that, because you see all these books about trial work, but you really don't see much about what corporate lawyers do. Mm-hmm. And I was a lawyer for 25 years, and I loved every minute of it. Now, I know there are lawyers out there that are gagging and saying, "Oh, yeah, right." But it's true. I loved it. And so I tried to get that feeling of what it's like to do a corporate deal, moving very fast, the camaraderie that develops between the people that are involved in it and the effort it takes, but the sense that you just become part of something that's bigger than yourself, that's moving along. And the best thing about corporate law is that you're all trying to get to the same goal. You're all trying to get the same place. I actually used in those scenes several funny little things that happened when I was a lawyer in corporate law. Really, just odd little quirky things that happen all the time.
You had that sense. You had that experience mm-hmm. when you were reading.
And I
this.
Had to put a lot of detail in there. I don't want to spoil anything, but the financial transaction has a lot to do with a triple surprise at the end of the book.
Oh, and it's a great surprise.
Oh, good. I'm so glad.
Oh, and you draw on a great American story, the story of D.B. Cooper in this book.
Right. D.B. Cooper has fascinated me forever and ever. I even got to the point, I went to the World War II Museum as part of the research for this book, and I found an old soldier, a gentleman who had been a jumper, a parachute jumper, in World War II in Europe during the war. And he was wonderful. He was about probably, I think, around 90 to 95 years old. He's a guard at the World War II Museum. And his face lit up when he was talking about those jumps. And I was really interested, especially in how much money did D.B. Cooper really get? Because, you know, the story was that it was $200,000. People might not remember, but D.B. Cooper in 1971 got on a plane, and about 10 minutes into the flight, he announced that he had a bomb. And he basically held the crew for ransom. The feds said they gave him $200,000 of unmarked bills because it moved too fast. He had the plane land. He let the passengers off. He was a nice hijacker. He let everybody off except the crew. And even the crew later said he was really nice. And then he got all this money, and he got parachutes. He demanded parachutes. The Air Force was trying to track him, and the police were trying to track him in the air, but it was a rainy night, and the plane took off. And at about 10,000 feet, D.B. Cooper jumped out of that plane with all the money and his parachute, and he was never seen again. And so after that, there were D.B. Cooper parties all over the country once a year. It was on Thanksgiving Eve. And everybody had a great time with D.B. Cooper for many years. And just about 6 months ago, another person got in the news when they said they knew who D.B. Cooper was.
Yes. But it never goes away.
I know, it never goes away, but it was disproved.
Oh, it's so much fun. It's so much fun. Well, we'll see more of Amelise and Jude in books to come, you think? Or?
Yes, I'm working on a third book right now. It'll come out, I think, in September or October of 2013. And it's Amelise and Jude, but it focuses more on Rebecca. Do you remember her friend, Rebecca?
Oh, yes.
Rebecca, who is competitive and yet has a good side that she doesn't like to show too much. And she just sort of does a good deed and then looks the other way and gripes at herself for doing it.
Like many people we know,
right,
I think.
Right. And Rebecca's very beautiful, much more beautiful than Amelise. She sucks all the oxygen out of the room when she walks in. And she and Amelise are competing for partnership coming up down the line. And so this next book is about Rebecca, and it's about partnership. And
female rivalry. Obviously.
Well, and it's also got a murder trial, very explosive murder trial.
Well, okay, we'll have to wait a while, but it'll be fun.
Okay. Thank you.
You can meet Pamela Bennings Ewan, who's also known as Pam Lott, when she signs Chasing the Wind Saturday, August 11th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Thanks a lot, Pam.
Thanks so much, Susan.
August, and that means the Katrina books are coming. I have mixed feelings about these, as do, I imagine, most New Orleanians. I understand people who swear they'll never read them. I sympathize with people who say they read all of them. And I even get it when people say they buy all of them but don't plan to read them anytime soon. This year, I've been inspired by two nonfiction books about the city's recovery. Daniel Wolfe's The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back, and Tom Wooten's We Shall Not Be Moved, Rebuilding Home in the Wake of Katrina. You'll be hearing about them on The Reading Life next week. And then there are the novels. I'm still thinking about those. Here's one for your consideration. Daniel Blake is a former British kidnap negotiator and confidential investigator and journalist who made his debut with the novel Thou Shalt Not Kill, featuring Pittsburgh detective Franco Patrese.
He's back this year with City of the Dead, which begins in pre-Katrina New Orleans and takes us right through the storm. After his last case, and after some time spent doing relief work in Thailand after the tsunami, the time was right for Franco Patrese to get out of Pittsburgh, and a job with the FBI in New Orleans seemed like a good escape. As we all know, there's crime enough for a million novels here, so Franco gets busy pretty quickly. There's a serial killer on the loose who leaves his victims in scenes that seem straight out of a voodoo hallucination, minus a leg, plus a snake, with a mirror bashed into their foreheads with an axe. If you like grisly details, they are here in abundance. And one of the first victims has a special tie to Patrese. When his boss takes him to a fancy party on St. Charles Avenue, she offers to become his confidential informant, saying that since Patrese's new in town, he's not yet tainted. Trouble is, she's killed on the night she was supposed to meet him at Checkpoint Charlie's. So for Franco Patrese, it's personal. And for his partner in the investigation, an African-American policewoman named Selma Fawcett, a devout Christian who has a few secrets of her own, it becomes personal as well. The two begin investigating a conspiracy that seems to include not only a prominent voodoo priestess, drug queenpin, who calls herself, what else, Marie Laveau, but also some of the most rich and powerful men in Louisiana. Blake does create an incredibly appealing character in Cat South, a reptile dealer who operates a business called Wyatt Herps. But here's the trouble for me with the City of the Dead. If you live in New Orleans and you're reading this book, you're bothered by the fact that Daniel Blake has Ray Nagin appear as himself, but creates a fictional governor and family. You can't have it both ways. It's hard to suspend belief when you know differently, when you know it in ways that are too utterly painful to contemplate as entertainment. As inventive and convoluted as the plot twists are, as fast as I was turning these pages, I was disturbed and depressed at the end of this book. Blake skillfully weaves his tales of voodoo. At one point, Franco finds himself in the midst of a ceremony in a cemetery at Marie Laveau's grave, naturally. With disaster capitalism, political conspiracy, and family secrets. Really, those are just other kinds of voodoo after all. It gets pretty preposterous. But when he has first responders marking doorways as early as August 30th, it's really the last straw. Here's how Patrese describes the devastated city. It was an end-of-the-world movie, an African war zone, something filtered through the cameras of Paramount or CNN, not something in real life. For those New Orleanians who live with the memory of that reality every day, this will be pretty hard to take. It's probably best to leave City of the Dead to readers who, as we like to say, are not from here. But I liked Franco, and I hope he makes a safe return to his beloved Pittsburgh, where he belongs. Here's what's untapped in the literary life this week. Authors After Dark is a romance writers and readers convention that takes place August 8th through 12th at the Royal Sonesta Hotel. Events include panels with authors, an autographing session with 80 authors, a steampunk tea, a wicked chocolate experience, an author's pub crawl, and much, much more. Check out authorsafterdark.org for more information. Today's guest, Pamela Binnings-Ewan, signs Chasing the Wind Saturday, August 11th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. And today's first guest, Ke'ini Ibora-Salam, signs Ancient Ancient, Monday, August 13th at 6 at Octavia Books, Wednesday, August 15th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop at the Healing Arts Center, where she appears with Moira Crone, author of The Not Yet, and Friday, August 17th at 6 p.m. at Community Book Center. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.